Good morning, everybody, and thank you so much, everybody, for being here. We're going to go ahead and get started. Can everybody hear me? Okay. Thank you all so much for being here today. I'm going to actually read a brief introduction, in part because this is going to be a podcast, and I know I'll forget to say the things that I wanted to say if I leave it all up to just speaking off the top of my head. I'm very pleased to welcome you all here to the first in Maynooth University's series of events marking the centenary year of the Easter Rising. This series, the subject of which is an all-island perspective on women in the decade of commemorations, is a response to the commemorative climate of the decade thus far, which has been marked by a number of particular characteristics. The first of these is the rather surprising lack of an all-island commemorative strategy. Given that events of recent decades have led to a sense of being in a largely post-conflict period in Ireland's history, and given the degree to which negotiations still reign when it comes to the politics of Northern Ireland, it's curious that so little attention seems to be paid to a consideration of what commemoration might look like across the island and how we might plan for it. However, when one considers that commemoration is always a reflection of current mores in politics, it is telling, isn't it, that in a bid to preserve what some would argue is still a fragile peace, we leave the commemoration to national governments on the one hand, or highly localized community groups on the other. There's little sign of power sharing, in other words, when it comes to commemoration. There's a pointed sense that the commemoration of the Battle of the Somme will mean something quite different to Northern Ireland and to the Republic of Ireland, and that there is little sense in embarking on a program together. It is, in a way, an impasse of the most polite kind, ongoing political signage that different factions acknowledge the meaning of past events for one another with a nod of the head, a laying of the wreath, a remembrance of the dead. The lack of an all-island commemorative strategy might seem, in other words, like the best possible political plan. However, 2016, in many ways, brings the easiest of the anniversaries facing us. The centenaries of the Easter Rising and the Battle of the Somme are not as divisive as those associated with the Civil War, nor with the 50th anniversary of the Troubles. A consideration of 2016 from an all-island perspective allows us to practice, in other words, for those far more incendiary commemorations to come. Commemoration is so often a performance, and a performance in this regard serves as a rehearsal for the more challenging commemorations that we face in the next 5 years. For this reason, Maynooth University's series attempts to consider commemoration as a practice, an issue from around the island. The second notable characteristic of commemorative events of the decade thus far has been the sometimes wholesale exclusion of women scholars, artists, writers, activists, and stakeholders from major events. The Royal Irish Academy's 1916 as a global event series is a notable case in point, with no women speakers. One defence offered, not by the RIA itself, I should add, was that since the RIA now has its first woman president in Mary Daly, this was somehow an acceptable state of affairs. The other most notable example is one I hardly need to say aloud, for it is the one that has changed the conversation. The Abbey Theatre is Waking the Rising programme. The response to the National Theatre's shocking exclusion of historic and present-day female playwrights has given birth to a whole language and has quite overwhelmed those who would have been quite happy to see the programme executed as it was originally planned. Waking the Feminists, with its multiple resonances, not to mention its absolutely brilliant acronym, WTF, seems to herald a shift in Irish theatre, but its influence has spread rapidly to launch conversations about gender in Irish film, in Irish art, and in Irish literature. Maynooth's 2016 series deliberately focuses on women and the decade of commemorations as a corrective to that national conversation. There are, I'm pleased to tell you, no manuals on any of the events planned for this coming year. This series also recognizes the need to shift commemorative strategy to reflect not only women's roles a century ago, but also the ways in which current commemorative practice often continues to fund an Irish strategy to keep discussions of women's rights, bodies, and lives out of the hands of women themselves. To that end, this series is not exclusively focused on the past, but also uses the past as a way to reflect on the present when it comes to women in an Irish context. The final notable characteristic of activities of the decade of commemoration thus far has been their domination by historians and historical discourse. This might, on the one hand, seem wholly logical. Historians' work is, of course, enormously valuable in considering events of 100 years ago, and so we might naturally look to historical texts to provide a précis of events or to consider a different angle of a well-known individual or to ponder the ways in which recent archival work challenges earlier narratives. And historical work, of course, does all of these things. but so does literary cultural work, so does anthropology, so does sociology, so does memory studies, and so on. Maynooth's 2016 series seeks to diversify the range of voices being heard about the past in the belief that historians do not have a stronger claim on the past than any other group, and that in fact our understanding would be amplified by an inclusive discussion that allows for different disciplinary approaches and ideas to mingle. These three aims of the series, to provide an all-island perspective, to focus on women and the decade of commemorations, and to consider multiple disciplinary voices, are brought together in the hope of developing a metacritical conversation about the ways in which memorial practice functions. The series of roundtables, masterclasses, and talks provides a model and framework extending beyond 2016 and has the potential to function as a space in which to reflect on commemorative practice as it unfolds and for those crucial years ahead. This leads me finally to an introduction to today's events, which have been generously funded by the Peace and Reconciliation Fund of the Department of Foreign Affairs. And we're honored to have four such distinguished scholars and thinkers launch this series. And I'll introduce two of them now and two of them in an hour's time. Both historians, I should add, who I hope I haven't offended with my analysis of events. And of course, we'd welcome your own thoughts on that analysis. I'll introduce Roisin and Mary. Do you want to come up and sit? I'll just introduce them while they're getting settled here. Dr. Roisin Higgins is a senior lecturer at the University of Teesside, a social and cultural historian with particular expertise in commemoration. Roisin is the author of Transforming 1916, Meaning, Memory, and the 50th Anniversary of the Easter Rising, published in 2012, a really wonderful book, which won the ACES James Donnelly Senior Prize for History and Social Science. She has been historical advisor to the commemoration zone of the GPO exhibition and is the project leader on a Heritage Lottery-funded project, Dear Mrs. Pennyman, which is carrying out research into letters sent to Mary Pennyman from widows and mothers of men from Britain and Ireland who died in action during the First World War. This project promises fascinating insights into memorialization since, as Roisin noted in an interview with the BBC last year, many commemorative projects focus on the dead, but this one will focus on those who had to live on. Given her expertise and the demand to hear her speak this year in particular, and particularly seeing that she's just flown in from Rome, we're honored that she agreed to join us here in Maynooth. As we said earlier, Maynooth is not all that far from Rome, really. Dr. Mary McAuliffe lectures on Irish women's and gender history in the School of Social Justice at UCD. She is a past president of the Women's History Association of Ireland and has published widely as a social historian with expertise in women's history, gender, and memory studies. Her books include a biography of Senator Kathleen Brown, and her work has been much in demand during the decade of commemorations. In 2014, she coordinated the centenary commemorations of the founding of Cumann na Bán, and including a national commemoration at Glasnevin Cemetery and a major conference held at Collins Barracks in Dublin. Her latest research project, We Were There, 77 Women of the Easter Rising, will be launched at the Irish Museum of Modern Art on March 8th. And Mary also served as consultant historian for the RCSI 1916 exhibition in conjunction with the National Commemoration of the Women of 1916, and this will launch on March 24th. So again, we're extremely fortunate that Mary has agreed to take time out to come and visit us. I'll hand you over it.
Thanks to everybody for coming along. Is this on or no? Oh. I was delighted when Una sent me the invitation or asked me if I'd become involved. It's true, I'm just back from Rome, and since the election of Pope Francis, I think Maynooth is more like Rome than Rome, in fact. But I'm delighted because it's important, and I wanted to be involved in this particular conversation. And then I had to think about, well, I want to be involved in it, but what have I got to add to it? What have I got to say? And I work on commemoration. I don't work specifically on women's history. I felt, as I was leaving the house this morning, there might be eggs thrown at me because I've done so little, I feel, for the cause of women's history. So the sense of being a fraud, I suppose a lot of academics, and particularly female academics, will recognise. So that's part of a shared experience, maybe. But when I was thinking about the rising and women and the commemoration of it, I was reminded of the story of Helena Maloney. She was a member of the Citizen Army. I'm sure many of you will know of her. She was released from Aylesbury Jail on Christmas Eve 1916. And with Ginny Shanahan and Winnie Carney, she decided the following year to have a demonstration to commemorate the rebellion on its first anniversary. They agreed the central features would be to beflag all the positions that had been occupied in the 1916 Rising and to get out the proclamation and to proclaim it again and to try to establish the position that the fight was not over and that the Republic still lives. Making three flags, and with the assistance of a Glaswegian sailor called Morn and Baby Murray, a Fianna boy, they managed to raise the tricolour onto a large flagstaff at the GPO. Their efforts were so successful that it took the authorities until 6 o'clock that evening to take it down, by which point a large crowd had gathered. The Irish Times reported that the anniversary was marked in Dublin by a good deal of excitement and gatherings, which together made up a very considerable aggregation of persons. So Maloney and her fellow organisers also ordered facsimiles of the proclamation using some of the typesetting from the original, but it was still in Liberty Hall, so they were able to retrieve some of it and create a replica. The plan to distribute the proclamations was abandoned because an order came, it was assumed from the IRB, that there were to be no demonstration and that flags were not to be flown. Maloney and Shanahan succeeded nevertheless in creating their own demonstration without the sanction of the trade union men, whom she said did not want the citizen army men there at all, and they displayed a calico scroll outside Liberty Hall which said, "James Connolly murdered, May the 12th, 1916. Now, Maloney told the Bureau of Military History, not without good reason, that this first celebration established the 1916 commemoration. And she's right, the central features had been identified. The proclamation, flags and emblems would become part of the battle of legitimacy, not just between Republicans and the state, but among Republicans themselves, and women would adopt the mantle of the guardians of the rising. And in an interesting little addition to that, on the first anniversary, when those elements of the original proclamation had been combined with new typeset to create the replica document, Maloney recalled being told by a representative of the National Library that there were more extant copies of the 1916 proclamation than that of the 1917 one. He told her, "The copy is more valuable than the original. We have three copies of the 1917 proclamation and 15 of the original." So for somebody who works on commemoration, that line, "the copy is more valuable than the original," is a nice line. So I suppose I tell you all that partly because where are the seeds of the choreography? We see the choreography of commemoration and the families, women, families, flags, the proclamation. They will all be there in different ways, in some form or another, I should say, during the centenary. So the commemoration of the rising is always a kind of a contest between that which is fixed, that choreography, the structure, and the fluid. And the fluid is a way in which the commemoration creates a discursive space. But what's also interesting about that story is women have curated the memory of the Easter Rising and its commemorations. They've written memoirs, they've tended graves, they've sat on committees, they've raised funds, they've protected the reputations of their male relatives. So why have women not been remembered? Why are women marginal if it's women who are the curators? And my work is on, the primary work has been on that 1966 commemoration. And when I looked at it, I mean, for me, I suppose, the thing that I return to again and again and again in my work and in my thinking about it is, why does the Easter Rising matter so much? And I've had to think about it all over again because having worked on this for over 10 years, probably 15, I think now, I didn't anticipate the frenzy that we'd see for the centenary. 10 years ago, I mean, there was the big celebration of the Celtic Tiger, really, for the 90th anniversary. That parade down O'Connell Street, the sense of congratulation. They said we couldn't rule ourselves, and look at us, we did it. Very little reflection, I think, in that commemoration. And then whenever the bottom fell out of the economy, there was no guarantee that the rising would be returned to as a moment of foundation. I did think people will look at it and say, we've been sold a myth. All of this was built on sand, and this is the and this is the sand. The rising is the sand on which this state, this nation, this idea of Ireland has been created. But in fact, it hasn't been. It's been returned to as the most potent symbol of the Irish nation. So part of what we're seeing in this frenzy, it seems to me, is a disillusionment with the way in which Ireland, with the southern state, has been run. And that's been deflected into this commemoration. But why the Easter Rising? Why would the disillusionment be channeled towards it? And partly I think it is because it is that moment of possibility. So within the Easter Rising, it's possible to feel a sense of hope and a sense of anger and a sense of disappointment and a sense of disillusionment. It captures all of that and provides to some extent a measurement of the ambition of the nation and the failures of the nation. So the rising somehow manages, and of course it hasn't been continuously commemorated. It's been a very difficult anniversary at times. So it's not that it's always been this, and this also because it is a reflection of the temper of the societies, north and south, at the time of its commemoration. It is also significant in that it tells us, commemorations, they tell us that we'll discover a lot, we'll know a lot more about Easter week when this is all over. What will be very interesting is what we see through the commemoration about the power structures that exist within the society. They tell you a lot more if you look about the society which is doing the commemorating. But in the midst of it, it's hard for us to see it. It maybe will take 40 or 50 years for somebody to come along and say, these were their preoccupations. They thought it was all about women, but in fact, it was all about something else. We don't know because we're too close to it. But one thing's for sure, it's not about Easter week. It's about now. So the rising matters for that reason, I think, because it provides a space to talk about so many things. And it provides, I think, there is a return to it. There's a genuine appetite for the history, and this is why the historians... somehow people feel, and I suppose historians are partly responsible for it, they talk about it as if they have a rare form of knowledge that can correct all the myths and the political abuse of the ideas, that they come along and say, no, if you listen to me, I have the answers, or I'll tell you what happened. That's what matters. I can see why people are sometimes troubled by the crowds of historians. But historians, that there is also a real interest within the society for the detail, for the stories. And in fact, somebody like me who talks about the commemoration, sometimes people don't. I'll spend an hour talking about the ways in which Patrick. I did spend an hour talking about the ways in which Patrick Pearse has been remembered in a talk in the Pearse Museum. Firsthand, before I'd even finished, the hand was, where was Patrick Pearse baptized? And people want, there is an interest in the detail. And I think part of the interest in the detail is a genuine interest in history and that kind of knowledge. But it is also because in that past, in that revolutionary period, there may be alternatives. In that past, there may be alternative futures. And there's something about that that pulls people towards it. There's also something about it that represents state nationalism, a conservatism within the state. So you get these two things operating at the same time, which is why so many groups within Irish society can form an interest around the Easter Rising. It serves those two purposes. And I work on, as I said, my book was on the 1966 commemoration. And I was always interested in the Easter Rising as, you know, there's the official programme. and what the government, the official line and the kind of the line, you know, so the official line from the government in 1966 was one which underlined the success and the importance of modernisation. It was linked very closely to Sean Lamassa's economic policy, explicitly and implicitly, consciously and subconsciously. But there it is in all of the, and this constant moving forwards and backwards from 1916 to 66 in television programmes, in, you know, even Insurrection, the very well-known TV drama for that year. The conceit is that it's a television crew from 1960, that's responding to, reporting the rising as it happens. They're on the spot. The newsmen are on the spot reporting from Banastrand. They're reporting from the GPO. They doorstep Pierce at St Enda's, put a microphone under his mouth. He won't be drawn. They're there. They get a response to, you know, to Owen McNeill's countermand in order. So all of these things. So it's a very present thing. And so what they do is they kind of, they impose this technological sophistication onto the story of the rising in a way that was more complicated than RTE, the Telefiche Éireann, could have carried out at the time. It was only 5 years old. They didn't have the money, they didn't have the capacity to cover an event that extensively live. So it's fantastical in all of these senses. But you get this this link between the present and the modern and the story of the rising. So they legitimise each other. But beyond that, the government can't control the story. Nobody can control the narrative. They'll try to, but they won't be able to do it because all of these other things seep through. And one of the most interesting in 66, of course, is that of Republicans, socialists, communists, and they reject that central narrative. They reject, and they are driven crazy by the idea that the Easter Rising was the thing which put into government Fianna Fáil. That government, that Fianna Fáil or Fine Gael or even Labour, that they're somehow the inheritors of that revolution. And they're constantly pushing against that story, which is being told everywhere in monuments and on TV shows and in plays and in lectures. Whether people know it or not, they're constantly making this link between 66 and 16. And so they reject it completely. So you get lots of really interesting economic arguments. Lamassa just signed a free trade agreement with Britain. Their plan is to join the European Union, the EEC. And so from the left, they're saying, where is the independence? You know, we're reliant on British capital. We're not independent of Britain. So they're having a genuinely challenging conversation. Of course, then there's the issue of partition and the severed state, the 26-county state. And it's the sisters of Sean McDiarmid who are, you know, some of the most vocal people in saying, we will not turn up to a commemoration that honours the 26-county state and that bans the Easter Lily. And of course, Cumann na mBan responsible for the design coming up and the popularity of the Easter Lily. What doesn't happen in 1966 is that the commemoration of the Easter Rising does not provide a space that women can lever. It seems to me that feminists can push open to create an interesting debate. So if the left is energised by it, and I don't mean there were no women on the left, but if you look at those three big, if you look at Labour, feminism and nationalism from the original event, two are energised in 66 and one is not. It seems to me, and actually maybe people don't agree, will disagree with that. And because of that, I'd always wondered what the Easter Rising could offer to feminists. Apart from saying there were more women involved than we thought or than we remember, what does the narrative offer to women? What does that model offer to feminists? And if you look at other commemorations, those big national days. Una and I were both in Australia a few years ago looking at how memory works in that society. Anzac Day has been challenged by feminists because of the way in which it normalises the military male, or even just the military state, the military nature of the state. And so with that, I thought actually the rising in many ways, what, you know, can women even have an interesting debate around that? If the rising offers a place in which to disrupt the authority of the state or challenge the authority of the state or challenge the authorities and the power structures within the society, how do women use it? And I still think that's a, I still think in some ways that's a question we shouldn't ditch, except, of course, that it has been answered in another way by Mary's Cumann na mBan, the activities in the conference, a landmark conference, really, on Cumann na mBan a couple of years ago, and the way in which women's history has been revitalised and energised by the upcoming centenary. And the way in which, and this is an international element, the way in which the all-male panels, the manels, have been challenged. And I myself, I was just like, when I came in, I said I was at a plenary in Rome, and I have no doubt I was invited because they had no women. And, you know, there was very, I don't want to say that in any, in a horrible way about the guy who organised it, but I feel at times, I feel a pressure always. I'm often the only woman on these kinds of panels. And in fact, the one thing last year, I turned something down because, and it was a young, I had the sense it was a young person, an assistant, who emailed me and asked me to do something. And they said, we need a lively female voice. And your name was mentioned. And I didn't want to be horrible to somebody who was in a research, you know, an assistant role, and I didn't want to get them into trouble, and I didn't, so I just declined. But I knew that they weren't saying to the professor on the panel, we need a retired, an old retired man, and you fit the demographic, you know. And so there are those politics are there always, I think, for women in academia. And what's truly extraordinary, I think, about the centenary, and I really would not have anticipated, as I would say, I just didn't see it. I didn't see how it could be. I could see how the Easter Rising disrupts power, but I couldn't. I didn't see how women could really use it, because I think women never really had. They had curated this other memory that accommodated an idea of a masculine heroic and hadn't successfully pushed it through to liberate themselves within in the present moment. So what's really wonderful about this is that the most interesting thing about the centenary will be gender politics, will be a feminist conversation. And it's entirely fitting within the history that this should be so. And that's nice too. There's, a good centenary will find authority for an interesting debate within the original moment, and it's there. And I suppose what will be really interesting is as this year begins, how we all participate in making that debate really matter and have and be the foundation for something very significant.
Okay, thank you very much. That's very interesting from Roisin. And at the end, you say about creating that space where perhaps now feminism rather than nationalism and maybe socialism in this decade of centenaries will begin. And in a different way to what Roisin is doing, what I want to talk about today is a project I'm very, very involved in, part of this commemorative process, but also different from it. Obviously, there's a history part, and I'm the historian on it with Liz Gillis, who has recent publication was a photographic history of women in the revolution. But it is also includes that feminist part, those feminist questions, that gender politics that's coming up. And I think it's providing a very interesting model. So it's good for me, having spent the last year and a half immersed in the research for this, to have a moment of reflection here with you today before it's actually launched on March the 8th, to which you're all invited, of course. And to tell you a little bit about the project, it's the project, the 77 Women Project for Richmond Barracks. Richmond Barracks is one of the major national commemorative restoration projects, and will be particularly focused on in May, because that's where the court-martials were held, of all the men, and obviously one woman, Countess Markovitch. But specific to that, before that, we're looking at the 77 women who were arrested in the immediate aftermath of the Rising. So it's really taking a particular cohort of women. Most of them are members of Cumann na mBan and the Irish Citizen Army. They fought at all the outposts except Bullen's Mill. And they reflect a cross-section of those women who were combatants in the Easter Rising. It's interesting, actually, as an aside, oftentimes when I give a talk on the 77 women, one of the first questions I'm always asked is, can we consider women as combatants in the Easter Rising? So I think there are questions coming up through doing this research and through reflecting on the role of women that perhaps haven't been asked before, or are being asked in a different way. And what the material is showing are different answers to that question, and no one particular answer. So lots of interesting things coming up. So the idea with the 77 women, they would form that central part, because they all were taken, when they were arrested, to Richmond Barracks to be sorted with all the other arrested men after the Easter Rising. They only spent one night there, but it allowed us to focus in on this particular group of women. So this photograph was taken about 2 weeks after they were released. Most of them were released on May the 8th and 9th. And they immediately start on that national fundraising event that they start, the National Aid Association, where they start fundraising for the families of those killed during the Rising and those now interred in camps in England and Wales and Ireland. And this is a reflection of the fact that the women's don't stop. The Easter Rising is not an end point for what the contribution is for the women. But as Roisin said, it is a major point where we can reflect on that moment of possibility, where you have cross-class collaboration between these women. As you can see from this photograph, these women are Kathy Lane, Madeleine French Mullen, very middle-class women involved in feminism, involved in trade union politics, and then involved in more militant or advanced nationalism prior to the Easter Rising. But it also includes working-class women like Rosie Hackett, who come through trade unionism in terms of their politicisation to involvement in the Easter Rising. So you have lots of journeys to politicisation, you have lots of different class backgrounds, you've lots of different histories here in that one photograph, and that's what this project is reflecting in that. I have answered the question on how they were chosen, and there are three aspects to this project. There's the history part, so that will be the book that will be produced, the We Were There, 77 Women of the Easter Rising. It includes detailed biographies based on the Cambridge Dictionary of Irish Biography, that sort of biography, of 74 of the 77 women. Couldn't find three of them, couldn't find any detail of them. And these are, most of them, I would say 65, 66 of them are completely unknown women. They have never made it into the history books. Their names were known in their neighbourhoods, maybe in their families, and now their contribution is made. What has been very interesting about doing these detailed biographies is not what they did in 1916, but what happens afterwards. And the activisms that these women continue to be involved in. And again, that's a hidden history that really hasn't been come out in our social and political histories of the Irish Free State, on into the Irish Free State. Many of them continue to be activists in a very similar way. And they're activists outside of those centres of power. They're in the margins, they're on the edges, but they are socially, politically active throughout those periods. Most of them are still alive into the 40s and 50s, indeed, some of them longer into the 60s and 70s. And they continue that activism. Quite a number of them, for example, are active in the campaign against the 1937 Constitution because of the insertion of those articles on women in the home. And what they hark back on, their main focus of their campaign against that 1937 Constitution is the proclamation. And the proclamation of full and or the promise of full and equal citizenship contained within that proclamation. So that's another aspect of the rising that comes out within this research. The centrality of the proclamation to these women's future politics, as it will be going on from 1916. Lots of other interesting things come out of that. But one of the most fascinating things for the future commemorations, and particularly around the Civil War, is the fact that the majority of the 77 women, and I'm broadening out that research now to look at the almost 300 women who participated in the rising in Dublin and the other, Ashburn and Wexford and Galway, is, it seems, so far, that a significant majority were anti-treaty going into the Civil War. So that kind of belies the notion that it was the central executive of Cumann na mBan that took the anti-treaty side, and the foot soldiers, or the larger body, was neutral or pro-treaty. That is what's coming out. Of course, that may change as the research goes on, but very interesting material coming up. So we're going to produce this in the book. This is a draft cover. It mightn't be the thing in the end, but we're going to put this out, this 77 Women project. And this is about starting a conversation about the broader involvement of women in the rising and then on into the War of Independence and the Civil War, moving it out from the leadership of Markovitch and Kathleen Lynn and Helena Maloney and those, and looking at more at what the broader membership of Cumann na mBan would have done. Of course, this particular piece of research concentrates on Dublin. But if we take that template, I suppose, and broaden it out into the War of Independence, we then look countrywide. We look at Cumann na mBan and various other organisations of women in the countryside. And will we see an urban-rural divide? Will the women in Cumann na mBan outside of the Dublin area, particularly those who hadn't been involved in the Easter Rising, be less radical in their politics? And those questions are beginning to come to the fore as well. One of the most interesting things about this is the images that are beginning to emerge from, you would think 100 years after the Rising we have all of the images that could possibly be there. But again, families are beginning to come forward with new images. And this is a very interesting image of the welcome home party of Countess Markovitch in 1917 at Liberty Hall. And it includes Rosie Hackett, Nora Connolly, Margaret Skinner, Kathleen Lynn, Madeleine French Mullen, Anya Kant. Again, you see, this is a year later. And as Roisin said, the women continue on their political journey. They had done the they started the first commemoration of the Easter Rising. But that isn't just what they're doing. They're also participating in all the big events that are happening. In fact, they're organizing them. It was Kathleen Lynn and a group of women with her who organised the Welcome Home, a massive demonstration of Republican ideology for Countess Markovitch as she came back into Dublin. But there's also other aspects which I think this photograph demonstrates. As you see the photograph over there of Kathleen Lynn and Madeleine French Mullen, what is coming through in the research is the relationships between the women. So ideas of personal relationships and political relationships, of networks and kinships and familial belongings to different organisations. So not only are the women having relationships with each other, we also see relationships between the women of Cumann na mBan and the Irish Volunteers. We see entire families joining the different organisations. So many of the women have brothers who are out in 1916, have brothers in the Citizen Army or brothers in the Irish Volunteers. The Norgroves, for example, the mother and father and the daughters are all out in 1916. So you see familial connections and radicalizations of families, of communities coming through in that research. And that begs questions, not just for 1916, but also for the type of politics and in community activism and feminist activism down to today. I was going to talk about some of the women, but just to give you an idea of them. This is Rose McNamara. She was the OC of the Inian na Héireann branch of Cumann na Mban. And again, that's another aspect of the research that's bringing out the sort of combination of the different groups that radicalise each other. Inian na Héireann had been around since the early 1900s. It was a separatist, militant separatist, feminist, and quasi-socialist organisation. In 1914, it's assumed into Cumann na Mban, and it brings that sense of radicalism into an organisation that, in its beginnings, is pretty moderate organisation. And they become a branch of their own within Cumann na Mban, on the south side of the city. And they are the one branch of Cumann na Mban that comes out in 1916 completely intact, because they're organised along quasi-military lines. And they end up serving in Maribor Lane, led by their officer commanding. They have military titles within that branch of Cumann na Mban, Rose McNamara, who walks out into the Easter Rising in full military dress. So again, that begs the question, were the women combatants? Did they see themselves as combatants? I think there's multiplicities of answers to that. Some of them did. We have Margaret Skinner, the girl sniper, as she's always called, which is amusing. She didn't see herself as a girl, but she did see herself as a sniper and a gun runner, who is wounded during an action to bomb the Russell Hotel on Harcourt Street, where she was in the Royal College of Surgeons during the Easter Rising. So these women, some of them see themselves as combatants, some of them do not. I think we have lots of different questions and lots of different answers coming out of this. Josie McGowan, for example, fights in 1916. In 1917, she's at an anti-conscription meeting in Foster Place, where she's baton charged by the DMP, the Dublin Metropolitan Police, and she is badly wounded and dies a week later. So those sacrifices by those women, she's not the only one, there are quite a number of the 77 women, four or five of them, who lose their lives, who lose their health because of their activism. So again, we have to ask the questions of the dedication and the ideologies. And these are the questions that our project is asking. And so what are these the themes that are emerging in this forensic analysis of the life and activism of the 77 women? Well, we're looking at the route to the rising. What was the politics behind these women? How were they politicised? Again, a multiplicity of answers is coming out. Many of them through nationalism, through feminism, through socialism. Some involved in all three. It's amazing how many organisations these women were in. You wonder where they got the time to attend all the meetings. Many of them would have been in Inian na Héireann, the Irish Women's Franchise League, the Irish Women Workers' Union, and then Cumann na Mban, and all at the same time, and going to all those meetings. But I guess they didn't have Rebellion to watch on television and things like that, so they had time to go out. And they were very much engaged with those. Another thing that's coming up in the research is the importance of the lockout in terms of politicising these women. The lockout, I think, has been an overlooked event in terms of women's history in Ireland. There's always the exception. Yes, the Jacobs Factory girls walked out and they were locked out, and then they all, many of them went back again. But what isn't really spoken about is the meeting space in that soup kitchen in Liberty Hall, where you had women from the Irish Women's Franchise League, women from Inian na Héireann, women from the Irish Women Workers Union, all coming together, all meeting, many for the first time. In fact, it's the place where Madeleine French Mullen and Kathleen Lynn meet for the first time. So love stories are created in the soup kitchen in Liberty Hall, as well as political alliances, as well as plans for activism. So we have to talk about that. What is very apparent in the research as well is how much of a working class history this is. Of the 77 women, the majority, over 60 of them, are from working class, inner city, tenements and artisan dwellings. We found most of them in the 1911 census. And they are the daughters of labourers, general labourers. They're the daughters of tradesmen. They're the daughters of, of the working class. So it's not a middle class revolution in terms of women's history. Of course the middle class women are there. And in fact, they are the more radicalised women. And they've been active more longer. They're also the older women. But the majority of the women are young, unmarried, working class women, getting politicised from about 1911 on, through involvement in the Irish Women Workers Union, through the lockout, and then for the women who are that little bit younger, perhaps had been too young to be involved in the lockout, the one big thing that they all mention that politicises them, and I think this was a lost opportunity for commemoration last year, was the O'Donovan Rossa funeral. It's the first time they see Cumann na mBan marching in uniform. And then they join after that. Of course, they must have already had some impact from the revolutionary ideals that were floating around. They didn't just join because they liked the uniforms. But the O'Donovan Rossa funeral is seen as a very important point. And it just shows how important propaganda was. And the women themselves become major propagandists after the Easter Rising. The other things is the radicalism. And people are afraid to use the word radical, I think. But I think we need to look back in that and see it as a radical choices these women are making. They're making radical choices about their politics, about their lives, about their relationships. Not just same-sex relationships, but also marriage relationships. The women are choosing who they are marrying themselves. They are love matches. They're falling in love with their comrades. So this is, a large-scale freeing of a younger generation from the mores of the older generation in lots of ways. And then the post-revolutionary decade activism. What happens after the Free State is set up? And that's really coming through as well for these women, how they were marginalised. How they were moved away from the centre of politics, how that moment of promise, that possibility, that those moments of possibility that the Easter Rising seemed to offer women is dissipated. What happens there and how do the women lose that? And again, another question that comes up from a lot of audiences is, why did the women go away? Well, it isn't that they went away. The state that was set up was not the state that they expected. So what happens then? How are they marginalised? And we have to ask those questions. I suppose in lots of ways I'm talking more about the questions we need to ask. And in terms of expanding the conversation. And we can expand this conversation in many ways. And the second part of the project of the 77 women is a legacy artistic project. And this is the quilt project and the legacy project, where 77 women take one of the women each, 77 modern day alive women, take one of the 77 women and do a response from their present day perspective in terms of a legacy. How do they feel about looking back at these women and their struggles and their ideologies and their politics and their activism and their successes and failures? And how do we respond as modern-day women? How does it inform our feminism? How does it inform our activism? And that project is ongoing and will also be launched on March the 8th at Emma. And I think that's very much connecting the 100 years ago with today and bringing to it a broader meaning than simply a historical narrative or a historic analysis and interpretation. It's really looking back at the last 100 years of women's activism and feminism and answering those questions about the state. What did the state offer to women in the end? So that brings in an awful lot of women. For example, you had said in your Una, in the blurb you sent out about the Magdalen laundries, an awful lot of women are talking about that and those responses to the state that was created out of that moment of possibility. And so that expansion of the conversation includes, you know, gender histories, labour and class histories, histories of sexualities, and then citizenship and belonging in a post-colonial state. And what that has meant for women, what that has meant for feminist activism. And in lots of ways, I'm not giving any answers today, other than the research was very, very interesting, and it brought up an awful lot of questions, and it has given me ideas for future research, and I could spend the rest of my career simply working on this one particular area. But I think it has allowed, it's one of the projects that has allowed questions to come up and to be asked that perhaps the state is not allowing in its own commemorative projects. And in lots of ways, that's because it's been a marginal project. It's not the main project of Richmond Barracks. The main project is the restoration and the court martials. So we were sort of left on our own, on the side, to ferment revolution in lots of ways. And it has become probably the most interesting, well, I would think, and possibly the best known part of the Richmond Barracks project to date, which is interesting. And it seems to be feeding into that concept that women's stories and women's histories and what the women did has become a major part of what this particular commemorative centenary is about. Just as in 1966, it was about something else. It's about the women today. Where that will lead us and what answers we'll get from that will be seen as we move on into the decade of centenaries. But I think it's no bad thing that those questions are being asked. And perhaps we'll never find answers, but we'll certainly move the story on a little bit. Thank you.